This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Welcome to Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex. I'm your host, Elisa Kreitman. This show is dedicated to providing today's modern women with useful information from industry experts in the areas of dating and relationship, sex and health, wealth and abundance. My goal is to have the information offered on this show support women in making empowered, conscious choices. Today on the show, I'm very excited to speak with the Venerable Rabina Curtin, who's a Tibetan Buddhist nun and executive director of the Liberation Prison Project. She's going to talk to us about happiness, how to find it, how to keep it. On the show today, we'll hear about Rabina's journey to becoming a Tibetan Buddhist nun and what inspired her to make such a choice. We'll learn about three attitudes that will change your life. And then we're going to talk about the Liberation Prison Project, as well as a live event happening in San Francisco called Happiness and Its Causes. I got a letter from a young Mexican-American prisoner in one of the top security prisons in California called Pelican Bay, right on just on the border of Oregon. And it was a very moving letter. I remember he told me he was 18. He had been in prison since he was 12, which is very common among some of these gangsters, from, you know. And he showed interest. He'd read a book of Lama Yeshe, interestingly called Introduction to Tantra. It was in his library at his prison. And he said he was moved by the talk of compassion. Well, you know, as we know, over the years, Buddhism sort of traveled to different countries. It began in India, you know, the Buddha is an Indian. And then in the 4th, 5th century, I think, from people coming from Asia, that it gradually went to China, and then to Japan, then eventually in about the 7th or 8th century to Tibet. And inevitably, because people and cultures are different, Buddhism, just like Christianity, you know, took on its own shapes and forms. What's going on today with our economy and the world in general, I think we could all use a little refresher course on how to find happiness and how to keep it. So, Rabina, thank you so much for being on Just for Women today.
I'm delighted to be here, Lisa. Thank you so much for having me.
So let me say a few words about Rabina. She has been a Tibetan Buddhist nun for over 30 years in the Gelugpa tradition, and we'll talk more about what that is. She spent 10 years editing for Wisdom Publications, followed by 5 years as the main editor of Mandala, an international Buddhist news magazine. She currently directs the Liberation Prison Project, which serves several hundred prisoners nationwide. She travels around the world teaching. Let me do that again. Cut! She travels around the world teaching Buddhism to students of all ages and levels, and her prison work was recently profiled in an award-winning documentary called Chasing Buddha. So, Rabina, you've been quite a busy bee, and I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to talk very candidly about some issues and questions that I know my listeners have, but, you know, not every day do we get to talk to a Tibetan Buddhist nun. So thank you for being on the show.
Great. Happy.
I read that you grew up Catholic, and now you have done such amazing work as a Tibetan Buddhist nun. How did you make that leap?
Well, I mean, like all things, you know, it's an evolutionary thing. It's not sort of like big lights flashing and changes occurring. It kind of happens in organic way, you know. Yeah, I was brought up a Catholic, and since a little girl, the kind of two main things, I had a strong connection with the religious thing. I loved going to Mass, but at the same time, I had this very inquiring mind and always looking for the big picture and always thinking, and also quite rebellious person. So, you know, the sort of the evolution in a quick sense was me, on the one side, loving to go to Mass, but then by the time I was 19 and going through my things, I decided very clearly that thank you very much, goodbye God, and hello sex, drugs, and jazz, actually. I was a real jazz fan. And that sort of 6 or 7 years, 8 years maybe, of political activity, very strongly me kind of looking for answers, but also looking for happiness too, you know. And then that evolved to when I was about 30, going through a whole series of things to come back to something spiritual. And this time I just bumped into these Tibetan Buddhists, you know, and I think I found my home there. So it's an evolutionary internal process, I suppose, is the simplest way to put it, you know.
Right. So tell us a little bit about the Gelugpa tradition. That is what the Dalai Lama and what most people know of in the West about Buddhism. So how does that differ from other Buddhist traditions?
Well, you know, as we know over the years, Buddhism sort of traveled to different countries. It began in India, you know, the Buddha is an Indian. And then in the 4th, 5th century, I think, from people coming from Asia, that it gradually went to China and then to Japan, then eventually in about the 7th or 8th century to Tibet. And inevitably, because people and cultures are different, Buddhism, just like Christianity, you know, took on its own shapes and forms. And so Tibetan Buddhism and all the Buddhists, like all the Christians, for example, have the basis the same, you know, but it's just developed very differently in this cultural packagings. And so it happens to be for me that the Tibetan Buddhist one, the broader one for Tibet, is quite appealing. But then because I like very much the philosophical approach, it's not just the usual way we think about religious of prayers and mantras and things. They have these great monastic universities, and there's a strong emphasis on really delving into the Buddha's nature, the Buddha's teachings about the universe and these things. So the Gelugpa, one of the four main traditions in Tibetan Buddhism that has developed over the last 1,200 years, it's kind of well known for this emphasis as well as on practice, but also on the philosophical, and that's probably its unique thing. Although, of course, finally they all come down to the same thing, Alisa.
Which is?
The fundamentals of Buddhism, really, I mean, it's about your mind. I mean, it sounds kind of cute to say it, but you really could say, when it comes right down to it, Buddha's this amazing psychologist. He doesn't use the word soul or spirit. He uses the word mind and consciousness, you know. And the essence of Buddha's teachings is that this consciousness of ours is not physical. It's a continuity. It doesn't just come from nowhere. It's not created by a superior being. It's not created by our parents. And this is where the whole Buddhist idea of, you know, Buddha's view of reincarnation comes in, that our consciousness is like a river of mental moments. It goes back and back and forward. And the unique thing of the Buddha's is, because he's saying we're not created, that our mind literally is our own. And then what's in it, the contents of it, this is this product of this fundamental law that Buddha would say runs the universe, and he calls it the law of karma. It just means the law of cause and effect, that what we do, say, and think kind of leaves imprints in this consciousness of ours, and we're sort of like literally producing ourselves and our experiences from moment to moment. This is the heart, really, of the Buddha's idea, this non-physical mind, a continuity, and then this law of cause and effect. They're the kind of the foundations of Buddha's view of the universe, you know, and of happiness and suffering. And that's the essence that all Buddhist ones share.
So even though we are born from physical parents and are, you know, raised in certain environments with certain teachers and influences from our parents, we're not necessarily that.
Yeah, that's exactly a very nice way to put it, Alisa. You know, I think if we're it's interesting, the two main views in the world, you think about it, you're either a theistic religious person and you believe in a creator, so your essence comes from God, or you're a materialist, you know, and so the essence, in a sense, comes from your parents. But the Buddha's got kind of this third view, if you like, that we've got the body, of course we do, we have the parents, you know, and the genes and the DNA and the chemicals and all this play a huge role. But the emphasis of Buddha's saying is that this consciousness didn't come from the parents, it came from before and literally went to that parent's egg and sperm, you know. And so the consciousness, the mind in Buddhist terms, it depends upon a decent working brain and a nervous system, but the anger, the love, the kindness, the jealousy, the depression, the goodness, all the parts of us, that's our own mind and it's our own, you know. That's the unique point that Buddha's making. And of course the implication of this is great, isn't it? It says that I'm responsible, not in a negative sense, but in a very empowering sense, which is what I certainly love about the Buddhist philosophical approach to life, you know.
Exactly, which is why I wanted to talk to you today.
Yes, right, great.
It's up to us, ladies.
Yes.
Okay, so you mentioned that you're in a monastic tradition, and so I really appreciate you letting me talk to you about sex and sexuality, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about that now, because, you know, we are sexual beings. Part of being human is our sexuality, so how do you deal with that from the monastic tradition?
Well, this, again, comes down to, you know, Buddha's explanation of mind and the tendencies we have, you know. We can see we've got one way of talking Buddhist psychology, or I've got a very simple kind of model of the mind. And this is linked very closely to the body, to the way the body works. So in the esoteric teachings in Buddha, which of course is known as Buddha's Tantrayana or Vajrayana, there's this marvelous little way of describing we have gross body and gross consciousness going together, subtle body and subtle consciousness. And we have very subtle body and very subtle consciousness. And so, and this is actually the model that's used in the Tibetan medical system, and it's a very sophisticated way of understanding our subtler energies as well as the gross. And so we can see at the physical level, we have a body, there's no question. We have the senses, and the senses are very powerful for us, there's no doubt about it. But as one Tibetan Lama said, we make the mistake of making the body the boss, because the mind is the boss in Buddhist terms. So what I mean by this is this. So then within the mind, you've got so-called positive states of mind, negative ones, and neutral ones. And one of the negative states of mind, and this needs a lot of clarity because we can often mishear it, is this one that's such a simple word, it's called attachment. And what Buddha means by that isn't simply pleasure or love, that's great, but is this kind of over-neurotic kind of craving, neediness for something out there that we think if we don't get it, we'll be miserable. So we kind of do all this hankering and craving and neediness. And so we dump that, of course, on food, on bodies, on you-know-what, you know, who knows what. So the negative aspect is there. That's the neediness, and that causes the suffering. But inevitably, because we've got this body, it comes along with what we call pleasure and pain, which we experience through our bodies. And so the so-called sexual one is a combination of the body, its nervous system, and then triggered by certain, say, a body that's out there, or even just a food or a pleasant smell, it triggers a physical experience. And then because we have attachment, we grasp at it like vampires, and we know what we're like, you know. So the actual simple physical experience of pleasure is just a function of the body, but combined with the mind, you know. And the Buddhist one helps you really get clear to extract the neurotic grasping part from it so that you can actually end up with, as one Lama put it, the more pleasure the better. So pleasure is not attachment. You know, being happy is fantastic. Pleasure is fantastic. The body, nothing wrong with it. But the mistake that we have and that causes all the suffering is the grasping at it, the neediness for it, the neurotic kind of manipulation of the situation in our lives to get this pleasure. I mean, that's a long answer, but that's a broad one. So the Buddhist view, what it does help you enormously is learn, as one Lama put it, to be your own therapist, to really go deeply into your own mind, to deconstruct what's there, to see all the neuroses, to see the emotions, and to extract kind of, to separate the positive parts of us, the love, the kindness, the happiness, the joy, from the neurotic, the misery, the depression, the neediness, you know. And when you can get clear about all of this, then you can have all the pleasure without your mind going berserk, as one Lama put it. So, okay, now coming, go on, so far so good. So go on, Alisa, say something more then, and I can talk about the monastic one now.
Yeah, no, that's where I was going.
Yep, that's right.
Go ahead.
Okay, so here we come. Given the Buddha's deal that attachment is all the neediness and expectations is a cause of a lot of our pain, then the Buddhist approach is one option for a person who wants to sort of take a retreat, if you like, from the very strong physical way of experiencing happiness, which, as we know, is called through having contact with other bodies. And I've made that very clear decision because I want to get to see my mind. I want to step back from it all. And then what I'm getting at is this. It is a drive in us, but the Buddha's view is when you know your mind well, you're not driven by those drives. You can drive your mind. You know where you're heading with it. It's not something you're stuck with. And I can see, for me, it was a very conscious choice. I mean, I was completely into sex and pleasure, and I'm totally into pleasure. I'm not as if I'm being all fundamentalist about it. But I knew that what drove me in my life more than anything was a wish to understand, a wish to be clear, a wish to go beyond all the neuroses, a wish to have to be in the best kind of control of my body, speech, and mind. So for me, it was a very conscious choice to become a nun, to give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll, if you like, but to give me the space. Like I said, it's almost like a retreat from things, to really give me the space to see my mind well, to deconstruct all the nonsense, and then to learn through that process, and this is finally the point, to really find my own bliss, my own joy, which Buddha would say finally is internal. And then, of course, when you've conquered all the nonsense, you can have the best of both worlds. You can have your cake and eat it too, you know, but maybe I have to wait for next life for that one.
Is that what you, I've heard that that tantrics,
yes,
utilize sexuality as a vehicle for enlightenment. So what you're saying in the monastic tradition, it's a retreat from things. It's sort of like mastering the separation between your mind and your body. And then is tantra sort of after you've you've come to that place?
No, you would say, I mean, there's many ways of understanding Tantra and the teachings, especially the way they're expressed in the Tibetan lineage of teachings, where it really is, it's the one area in the world, I think, one kind of tradition where it really is a living, amazing tradition. It's an incredibly sophisticated system, you know, sort of it trickles down into our Western world in a fairly simplistic way, with, you know, inevitably. But the essence of the Tantric approach, which is all part of the big Buddhist approach, it's a bit like sort of at the very first level of practice when you're out of control, you've got to back away from the object. So then the second level of it is you begin to see your mind more clearly. The third level is you're so together, you're so advanced, and I'm talking serious advanced practitioners, you can then kind of engage in an object without the mind going berserk. So you would say that it's part of, you know, one, if you're a Tibetan Buddhist, you do practices that are coming from Tantra, but they're internal. You know, not as like you engage with a physical object. You don't need to because it's an internal thing finally. And when you've really conquered your mind, when you're enlightened, and that's highly advanced, of course, then you're not in the throw. You're not at all like a prisoner of all the nonsense. You can have complete, total understanding of the universe and your own mind and everything else, you know. So the Tantric approach is a very advanced approach, and it's not just a question of having better sex, which is a gross way of understanding it. It's a way. It's a very sophisticated psychological approach to understanding and manipulating your own subtler physical and psychological energies. And I'm talking, you know, at a quite a sophisticated level. That's the essence of it, really. And all of it, because it's Buddha's teachings, is a way of helping you transform yourself and to become this marvelous being that Buddha would say we've all got the innate potential to become, you know?
Right. And the reason why I ask and want to spend a few minutes on this is because sexuality in our culture is just so out of control, and it is such a source of suffering for people. And I think pleasure, like you're saying, at a gross level, but there's so much more.
Yes.
To what happens to us when we become sexual, get married, and then, you know, I'm constantly looking at the divorce rate and what's going on between
That's
men and
right.
women, and, you know, there's such confusion. And so it's so interesting to get the perspective from someone like you who's celibate, right? Like
yes, that's right. Exactly. That's right.
Yeah, and then understand what that's about mm-hmm. and that there is such a...
Yes.
There are levels of understanding of body and sexual energy and what to do when it comes up because we are sexual beings.
Yes.
And so you're saying that there's very specific practices that you do that help you separate something that's innate inside your body.
Well, the thing is, yes, and the crux of this, the crux of our ability to really be in control of our lives and our body, speech, and mind in the Buddhist view is come down to this whole business of knowing your mind well. Because when we think of, say, attachment to anything, just forget the body. Just think of a chocolate cake, you know. The real point is this. Buddha's saying there's several things happening simultaneously. So, for example, you know, when your eyes see the shape and color, it triggers your mental consciousness and you go, oh, you sort of pull up your mental computer and you go, oh, yeah, that's called a chocolate cake. And then you remember having had it before. You remember enjoying it before. This is all happening in like a split second, right, because we're trained in it. We're sort of brainwashed into knowing about chocolate cakes. But the crucial thing is this. There's a series of positive states of mind going on there. It's fine to say it's a chocolate cake. It's good to say you've enjoyed it, and it's fine to enjoy it again. But the other one, this attachment, this neurotic one, which runs the show right now, comes straight in and runs the whole show. And what that does is that part of your mind causes the cake to look really more delicious than it is. It causes all the hankering. It causes all the overexcitement. And then it's kind of got this little story so quick we can't hear it, that then believes totally that when I get that cake, then I'll get happy. And that's all the attachment part. Attachment is neediness. Attachment is expectations. Attachment is manipulation. Attachment is kind of, you know, expecting. And all that's running real deep in our minds, and we don't even notice it. So we shove the cake in, and we're kind of waiting for the happiness to come. We don't get it, so we shove another piece in. We don't get it, we shove another piece in. And before we know it, we're too stuffed, and we can't put another piece in, and all we end up with is misery. So the thing that causes the suffering isn't the cake, isn't the pleasure, isn't, you know, the more pleasure the better. Please enjoy cake. But the attachment is the needy part. So, of course, when we dump that onto a human being, it's far more intense, it's far more powerful, and therefore brings far more suffering, because cake doesn't mind if you stuff it in, but human beings are different, you know. So it's not sex that causes problems. It's not happiness that causes problems. It's not love. It's not kindness. It's this neurotic neediness, which is so pervasive inside us. We hardly even give it a name in the West. That's what causes all the pain, you know. That's what causes the suffering in sexual relations. relationships, not the sex itself. It's a real subtle point, but we usually don't, in our, I think, psychological models in the West, we don't really see it as clearly as this. It's in my opinion, you know, my own study and my own practice over these years, I would suggest that, you know.
Absolutely. And then when we, after the break, we're going to talk about these different attitudes that can change your life, and I think you're starting to point to them now. It's not about the sex, it's about the clinging and the neurosis that we put onto it versus being empowered ourselves,
exactly.
knowing that the person or the cake is not the thing that's going to make us happy.
We are. Exactly right, yep. That's the essence of it.
Let me ask you a quick question before we go to the break, and I want to ask you about abortion. And
yes.
If your tradition is celibacy, how do you deal with abortion, and from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective? And how do women like yourself who maybe, you know, were out there and then you found Buddhism and maybe there was some sort of experience like that, how do women heal from that? And what does the Tibetan Buddhist perspective say about abortion?
Well, it's not even just the Tibetan Buddhist, it's the fundamental Buddhist view, which is also brings me up one point, Alisa, that it's important to say here, because when we think of religion, we tend to think to believe in something, you know, but the Buddhist emphasis, and I want to say this in relation to anything I'm saying here, it's sort of like Buddha saying, listen, you people, don't believe a single word I'm telling you. Everything that is called Buddhism is simply coming from the direct experience of this person called Buddha. It's something that he says we need to, you know, if we want to, we can listen to it, think about it, and then eventually verify it for ourselves. There's no concept in Buddhism of merely believing something. So, okay, that's the first way, just to remember to listen like that. The other one is the Buddhist view is fundamental about there are countless living beings in the universe. This nice word, actually, the term they use in Buddhism, as we know, is sentient being, you know. And in Tibetan, the word is mind possessor. That's what it literally means, sem chen. So Buddha says there's limitless sentient beings. There's humans, there's all other kinds we can't see. There are animals. They're all got mind. They're all mind possessors. And the fundamental point in Buddhism is we all want to be happy. Every living being. You watch the ant, you watch the giraffe, you watch the dog, the human. If you look at even behavior, we go towards what we think will give us happiness. We move away from what we think will cause us suffering. So that's a fundamental starting point. Countless minds, they all want happiness. So then the essential thing in Buddhism is if you want to have one thing to use in your life, Buddha would say, do not harm any living being. It's fundamental. But not because he says so, not in like the religious guilty sense, you shouldn't because God said so. He says, it's practical. You shouldn't harm others because guess what? They don't like it. So there's that fundamental starting point. You know, then there's the one, of course, Buddha would suggest that a living being is a mind. And so from the first second of conception in an ant's egg or in a giraffe's, you know, egg and sperm or a human, what causes an egg and sperm to come together in Buddhist view is the entry into it of a consciousness from before. So it's not as if God puts a soul in there, which is the Christian one, or the Buddhist or the materialist one is you're merely an egg and sperm, you know. But the literal cause of why the egg and sperm stay together and then begin to develop into a fetus, that indicates in Buddhist view the presence of consciousness, the presence of a living being for who a few weeks ago was in another body. So the Buddhist view would be that it's asserting from the first second of conception you simply have a living being there. Indeed, it's a very tiny one, but it's still a real consciousness, you know, an unbroken continuity of mental moments that from another body due to very strong karmic connection went into that body. So, okay, when I was 23 and I was this old radical hippie and I was moving into my political days, I got pregnant. And it was very fascinating, by the way, that I remember the person I got pregnant with. I remember the day. I remember the moment because I had this strong sense, and I tell you, I never thought of those things then. I knew something had gone inside me, a consciousness, a being. I couldn't even find words for it. It was a very vivid experience. I knew I'd got pregnant, in other words. And, of course, the doctors verified it. And it was in the 60s, so I very happily had an abortion. I didn't want to know about a baby. But, you know, so the Buddhist view would be something a consciousness went inside me at that second. And that's what the moment of the beginning of a being is. So given that it is a mind, given that it doesn't want to suffer, then the Buddhist view very simply was, well, of course you wouldn't kill it, you know. Abortion is simply killing a sentient being. So there's no kind of guilt involved. It's just trying to be thinking about these points, and then we come to our own conclusions from this. So, of course, life's not simple. There are many, many factors that determine our choices. But this is a basis, would be a basis for a person who is attempting to live in this way would use to make their decisions, you know. So that's a long answer, but that's the basis of the way a Buddhist would think. Do you get my point?
I so appreciate you sharing that because, wow, what an amazing opportunity for us to learn and heal, because I know abortion is such a huge issue.
Yes.
I mean, it, all across the world. But to get
yes.
a perspective from you with, I mean, I had no idea you had a personal experience of that. And
yes,
know,
absolutely.
And to really get the Buddhist perspective of consciousness starts
yes.
immediately, and
that's
what keeps
right.
it there. And
that's
yes,
right.
there's no guilt. There's no
it's
guilt.
It's so important. Guilt in Buddhist terms is sort of like not taking responsibility. It's a question of, okay, I look back in my own life. I thought, okay, I did that abortion. I had my motive at the time. I could say it was sort of self-centered, but it was ignorant more than anything. I never thought of it as a living being. And what was so interesting, when I went to the hospital, and, you know, I got it on the National Health in England. I was living there at the time. The nurses were so kind to me. But I remember I got deeply depressed. I couldn't put together why, but I can see back now, because we have a strong sense that there is something alive there, you know. So I made that choice then. So the Buddhist approach, we have these wonderful practices. We call it purification. There's no action. There's no negative action. There's no karma that can't be purified. There's no concept in Buddhism of blame. There's no concept of punishment, because we are the creators of our own experiences, and so we can change who we are. So it's to, okay, I think about that. I can assume there was a being there. So I have this deepest regret for myself, because every action you do brings results for yourself, but also for the sake of harming another being. And then I vow never to do it again. So there's nothing that can't be healed in the Buddhist view, but it's you have to do the healing based upon techniques, based upon your reliance upon the Buddha's practices, whatever you like, you know. There's no concept of guilt and blame in Buddhism, nothing like that.
Rabina, you are amazing. We're going to take a short break to support our sponsors. This is Elisa Kreitman, your host of Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex. I'm speaking with the Venerable Rabina Curtin, Buddhist nun, Tibetan Buddhist nun, and executive director of the Liberation Prison Project. And we'll be right back.
Listen to Living Dialogues, thought leaders in transforming ourselves and our global community, with Duncan Campbell, visionary conversationalist, bringing you the best in new paradigm thinking on personallifemedia.com.
We're back. I'm Elisa Kreitman, your host of Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex. We are having an amazing conversation with Rabina Curtin, Tibetan Buddhist nun, who's talking to us today about Tibetan Buddhism, what that's like, the fundamental principles of Tibetan Buddhism, and how it can really have an enormous impact on our lives today, knowing that we're the creators of what goes on and that nothing, really nothing, is unforgivable or undoable. So, Rabina, let's talk a little bit about these three attitudes that will change your life. I think just knowing that we're the creators and, you know, there's nothing you can't sort of undo is one step. Is that one of the steps, one of the attitudes that you're going to talk about?
Absolutely. I mean, this is very much the Buddhist idea that sort of we're the creators of our own reality. Our minds go back and back. Every split second of what we say, do, and think is a karma. It just means an action, really, that brings a reaction in our own minds. And so more and more for a person who is a Buddhist, you kind of take this on board experientially. The implications of this are that we are responsible for the happiness, we're responsible for the suffering, and we can change and become what we want. You know, that's the simple thing of it. And that's the part that I've found over these years. You know, of course, as you keep practicing, it gets deeper and deeper. It's the most empowering idea, you know?
Right. And so are there other attitudes that you would offer?
Well, I'd say, you know, the fundamentals in Buddhism would be that based upon the mind being your own, not coming from your parents, not coming from a creator, and that brings this sense of empowerment. But the other one, as I said, that increases that one is this idea of karma, cause and effect, that everything you say, do, and think is producing you literally from moment to moment. And then on the basis of that, actually, you get some compassion for yourself. There's this lovely analogy in Buddhism that a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. So you could really put all the practices into both these wings. And the wisdom wing is this intensive work you do on yourself, understanding your own mind, crucially knowing that you don't want suffering. But the major piece is realizing that what I do say and think is the cause of my suffering, as well as the cause of my happiness, which then puts you in charge, then gives you courage, then on the basis of this, you really, it's like saying you get compassion for yourself. And then on the basis of this, you can then start to look at others and realize that they're the ones who have caused their own suffering and happiness as well. And on the basis of this, you have compassion for them. But a kind of a mature compassion, not like compassion for victims or the poor things, they can't help it, but a compassion based on wisdom. But you know, you can then help others find the methods to help themselves. So it's the two wings idea that I really like, you know.
Which is really inspiring and is a great segue into your work with prisoners and the Liberation Prison Project. So is that how you got into working with prisoners, finding your own wisdom for yourself and that, you know, your life is really your responsibility and then helping prisoners understand that?
Well, no, like a lot of things, you know, if you're really working on yourself, you just go along, you take, and you sort of learn to be very conscious of what comes up in front of you, and you try to take that opportunity when it comes. So I had no plan to work with people in prison. What happened was in 94, I came to this country, and because I'm part of a worldwide organization of Buddhist activities, and my first years were spent working with Wisdom Publications, as you mentioned, when we were based in England, but also teaching for the last 20 years at centers around the world. Then I was invited to come here to California in 94, and I then took on the job of editing the magazine of our organization. That was Mandala, as you mentioned before. And then in 96, I got a letter from a young Mexican-American prisoner in one of the top security prisons in California called Pelican Bay, right on just on the border of Oregon. And it was a very moving letter. I remember he told me he was 18. He had been in prison since he was 12, which is very common among some of these gangsters, from, you know. And he showed interest. He'd read a book of Lama Yeshe, interestingly called Introduction to Tantra. It was in his library at his prison. And he said he was moved by the talk of compassion. So I wrote back to him. I sent him some books, and then eventually he became a Buddhist. He took refuge. I went to visit him. And then the whole prison project grew from there. Within a year, I had 40 people writing to me. It was all by word of mouth. But now we have this nonprofit. I have 8-9 full-time staff, 180 volunteers around the world. We get 1,000 letters a month just in our U.S. office. I have a budget of like $40,000-$50,000 a month, which I have to raise, of course, to pay salaries. And we really, it's built up into this incredible project where we help people who write to us, because, you know, as a Buddhist, you don't try to convert people. That's considered very bad manners. You respond to demand. So we get these letters, you know. And then we have all the volunteers around the world who then write to the prisoners and give them support. We have a huge resources department of our books. We send 50 packages a day out to prisons. We offer books. So it's just grown this way. We're also now in Australia for many years, and we're helping supporting prison projects in Colombia, in Mexico, Spain, Mongolia. So it's growing like crazy, you know.
Wow, that is nice. What about women? Do you work with women in prison?
Well, you know, this is fascinating. Because you don't kind of go out there and proselytize, it's very inappropriate, as I said, for the Buddhists. You respond to demand. And it's fascinating. You go to Buddhist centers, if you go to churches, you're going to find 60-70% is female. But for some reason, Alisa, and I do not really know why, I could speculate, but there's no benefit. It's astonishing, actually, in that the 14 years we've been going, 12 years, sorry, I would say 99% of all letters, and we get 1,000 a month now, are from men. Don't ask me why. There are thousands of women in prison. But it's just fascinating, you know, what the reason is. And one of the things that people have suggested to me is that I don't really know the reason. I don't want to speculate. That the suffering of women is very specific, and really it seems to be the vast majority of women in prison, I've heard this, the suffering comes down to the one of the loss of the children, the loss of the family. So maybe there's a preoccupation with life at that level, whereas I don't know what it is. I could say things, but it doesn't really matter. But 98%, 99% of our letters come from men. We have women who write to us. Of course we do. I've got two women here employed who've both been in prison. That's how we met them, you know. So it's kind of fascinating.
Huh, interesting. Of course, I'm like, speculate.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. You can have all the cliched ideas, but the reality is most of the letters we get are from men in prison, and there are thousands of women in prison in this country. So I don't know why. Curious, isn't it?
Maybe it'll shift. Maybe someone will hear this, interview. And
exactly.
And start to wake up and want to heal.
Absolutely. Because I will go wherever. We will do whatever. If we're requested, we will go there, you know. There's no doubt about that.
I really like what you said about responding to demand.
Yes.
Versus proselytizing.
It really is a huge difference, I think. And the simple logical reason is, you know, that, you know, no one can force you to think something. So to try and force a person to think a certain way in a religious sense is really inappropriate. A person has to be, we all know when you're ready for it, you will go for it. You've got to be ready. Then you're open to it, you know. And we can see this in our own lives again and again.
Right. Yeah. It never works when there's this sort of charge to do it, especially with family members.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh, yes.
So what do you mean when you say the prisoners take refuge?
Oh, it's just this nice phrase they use in Buddhism for when you've made a commitment yourself that you want to follow the Buddha's, you know, have the Buddha's views as your path in your life. You make a formal commit. You have a formal little ceremony. We do it on the telephone with our prisoners. Normally you do it in front of a person. And when they're ready to commit themselves to wanting to live according to Buddha's teachings, to not harm others, and then you take these little vows, never to kill, never to lie, never to steal, etc. And that's really just this formal little thing of where you learn, then you commit yourself to rely upon, if you like, the Buddha's teachings. It's a very nice little ceremony.
Well, I can imagine that is transforming. You know, I think a big complaint of a lot of people is that prisoners go in like this young man you were talking about, 12 years old.
That's it, exactly.
If there is no transformation in prison, he's got no shot.
No, that's the one. And that's where, for us, it's incredibly empowering. And I'm not just saying it's only Buddhism. And many people help people in prison in many ways. But we're seeing the response in our letters. It's unbelievable. We put a newsletter out every 2 months because it's sort of that's where the prisoners can get their community because they can't write to each other. So the number of things that people, the talk of finding the methods to transform themselves, and it's just extraordinary to see the result of people who do have a connection with Buddhism and who are able to use the tools at their own level. Some of our guys, all of our people, including the women, are amazing practitioners. Some just need a really good friend, want support, want encouragement. And at one the most basic level, that's what we give, is enormous encouragement and support that, listen, you can change. You don't need to define yourself by your negative things. You aren't innately evil. And that's a very empowering thing to hear, especially when you're part of the lowest level of society in a prison where you've only had garbage all your lives, which is so many of our people in prison, to actually hear someone say you're worthwhile, you've got qualities that you can change, that's so empowering. And I can see that's the greatest gift we give, you know, hope and inspiration to know you've got human qualities. We've all got the possibility to change. We just have to know it ourselves.
Thank you. I'm so inspired by what you're saying. Before we wrap up, let's talk about this event coming up in November in San Francisco, Happiness and Its Causes, an exploration of human happiness. Who are the speakers? How did this come together? Why are you excited about it?
Yes. Well, over the years, as I mentioned to you, you know, I've been doing this project for about 12 years, and I've been doing other things, all my, you know, working in the Buddhist centers and seeing over the years, traveling around the world, we tend to have this really dualistic view. There's pleasure and happiness over there, and there's boring old religion over the other side, and we tend not to put them together. So then we think, oh, money is a dirty thing, and management is all kind of worldly. So often the Buddhist centers I've seen are kind of poverty mentality and not very successfully run because we have this misconception about spiritual. So I'm seeing it's ridiculous, you know. There's nothing innately bad about money or anything else. It's if you have a pure motivation, then everything's fantastic. So over the years, too, having to raise all this money, I mean, I'm spending $40,000 to $50,000 a month. I don't even know where I get it from sometimes. But I really can see I've needed to come up with creative ways of making the money. And for many years now, you know, I've thought not just to do the begging mentality. I don't want to get out there and beg people's money from them. I'd rather be a bit like an entrepreneur and come up with different ways. So we have a Buddhist book cafe here. We're trying to do commercial things. And so this, I was in Sydney last year. Our center there invited me to come to this conference called, in fact, Happiness and Its Causes. It was started by my colleague in Sydney, Tony Steele, who in his own life has a huge worldwide company that runs conferences, you know, for businesses. And he started a couple to help support his center. And the 3,500 people came. The Dalai Lama was one of the speakers. And from the point of view of money, he made, you know, like $1 million profit to run his center. And I thought, oh, my God, we should do this in San Francisco. What a wonderful title for a start. And then it's something that you don't charge for Buddha's teachings, really. People come and they give a donation. But the world accepts the conference thing. You pay $500 for a weekend. You go to workshops, you know.
Yeah.
So first of all, I thought, what a great way to get ourselves out there in a bigger way. You can't, you know, not Buddhist only. It's a great topic. It's so much talking these days about happiness. And then so this is, we've got about 40 people, and we plug it, we call it, you know, we've got 40 of the best minds in psychology, philosophy, medicine, you know, healing, the arts, sports. We've got people from all different walks of life, really qualified, marvelous people, all talking about happiness and how to accomplish it, what it is, how we define it. And it's just this really marvelous kind of energy that's grown around this thing now, you know, and it's, so we've booked a place. It's in San Francisco. We hope to get 1,000 people to fill the venue. We haven't got all the registrations yet, but it's creating so much of a buzz already. We've got ads on the back of buses in San Francisco. We're putting them in the BART trains. We've put 100,000 brochures out there. We're doing all the best things we can to bring in 1,000 people. And it's got people are loving the idea of it, you know. And all, we've got some of the best speakers, Paul Ekman, one of the best psychologists of the 20th century, really great people from Stanford, from Berkeley, from Harvard, one of the, you know, historian of science. We've got a politician. We've got a young woman who's done judo all her life, talking about the benefits. Who was in the judo team in the Olympics, talking about the benefits of a physical discipline. I've got an amazing woman called Gina Gibney from New York, who's a dancer, and she's got a women's company, and they go into shelters and work with abused women and children using movement. I've got an orchestra conductor talking about the benefits of song. We've got wonderful things. We've got a gala concert where we've commissioned a piece by this amazing Guatemalan composer. He's written an incredible little piece for us, an orchestral poem called Buddha Phonias, The Sound of the Buddha. He's written this 12-minute piece. We've got a fundraising concert for our prison project and for the school across the road from us. So many things are going on. I'm really just having fun doing it. It's hard work, but it's a great way to get us out into the world, to bring in people who wouldn't normally come to a Buddhist thing, but who can hear about happiness, hear about the mind, and inspire people. That's the idea. And, of course, hopefully bring in some extra profit so we can run our prison project. That's the thing behind it.
And that makes all the difference, I think, too. And I really appreciate what you said about money isn't fundamentally an evil. And
of course it's not.
You know, it's like sex is evil, money is
that's
evil.
Right. We're so fundamentalist. That's the trouble. We get into religion, we kind of lose our common sense. We get all fundamentalist and kind of guilty, and that I find is a really unhealthy attitude, Lisa. Really inappropriate.
Yeah, and even though Buddhism is a religion, it's really about liberating ourselves
totally
and our
that.
Minds
that's
and
exactly
being
right.
fully empowered.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
And if people want to learn more about happiness and its causes, what's
yes.
the website?
Well, you can go to, it's a long one, happinessanditscausessf.com, or you can just simply go happinesssf, San Francisco, happinesssf.com.
Okay, great.
That will go there.
And if people want to learn more about the work you're doing in prisons, where
yes.
should they go?
That's liberationprisonproject.org. But if they go to the happiness one, you'll see our logo. They can link on it from there if you like. So go to the happinesssf.com, and you can go down and you'll see our logo, or it's liberationprisonproject.org. And I would love to hear from people. It would be fantastic. Come to our conference. You'll have a great time.
Yes, I will be there, and I'm very excited to meet you in person and
yes.
learn more about what's going on
yes.
many different levels about being happy. So, listeners, come to San Francisco in November. What are the exact dates, Rabina?
The main conference, the 2 days, is Monday and Tuesday, the 24th and 25th of November, which people will realize is the Monday and Tuesday before Thanksgiving, but there's lots of stuff happening in San Francisco at that time, so the dates are great. And then we've got on the Sunday and the Wednesday, there are workshops, wonderful workshops. We've got a drumming workshop, somebody who works with drug addicts using drums. We've got Gina Gibney doing her movement stuff. We've got people talking about restorative justice, because we have two people talking whose children were murdered who have forgiveness for their murderers. So these wonderful workshops as well as the conference itself. But the heart of the conference is Monday and Tuesday, November 24 and 25, at a very lovely venue in downtown San Francisco.
That is fantastic. Rabina, thank you so much for being on Just for Women today and talking so candidly and openly about what is possible for us, not only as women being empowered, but as human beings being empowered and loving and empowering each other. It's really been a gift to talk to you today.
I'm so happy, Alisa, for the wonderful conversation we've all had.
Thank you. And listeners, a reminder, you can email me at Alisa, A-L-I-S-S-A, at personallifemedia.com. We would love any of your comments, ideas you might have for future shows. Happy to include that. For text and transcripts of this show and other shows on the Personal Life Media Network, just visit our website at personallifemedia.com. For a copy of my book, Alisa's Four Cornerstones to Living Your Dreams, just head over to my website, sacredspa.org, and click on the book icon cover. And also, if you want to leave me a message, a phone message, here's the phone number, 206-350-5333. I'd love to hear any questions or comments you have as well. So, again, Rabina, thank you again. Everyone, come out to the Happiness and Its Causes event happening in San Francisco, November 24th and 25th. If it's any way energetic as you are, Rabina, we're going to have a really, really good time.
Good. I think energy is the key to success, isn't it?
Yeah, so thank you again. And listeners, tune in next week for more juicy news you can use. This is Elisa Kreitman, your host of Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.